Hello dear listeners, Editing Leo here. Just so you know, this episode contains some mention of violence at some point. Just as a quick heads up if that bothers you. Alright, now, on to the episode. I hope you like it. Hello and welcome to episode 13 of the Universe Podcast. I'm your host Leo, here with my co-host Charlotte.
Hello!
And our guest, Marie.
Hi.
Hello, everybody. Marie, I know you've been on the show before, and people might already know you, but still, could you introduce yourself?
Well, I'm very honoured to be here for the 13th episode, which is obviously cursed. I am the president of the universe, and the founder.
Nice to have you here. We're going to start with the reading, as we've done during the last couple of times. Marie is going to read a piece called Lessons from the Berry Picker.
Should I just go right into it?
Yeah, you just start reading.
Lessons of the Berry Picker. Lesson number one. They keep the quiet ones alive. Those who scream at their arrival are pierced through the chest and dissipate like smoke around their polished beaks. Lesson number two. They're beautiful. I stare as their white bones glow in the night. I think of snow, of the light at the end of a tunnel, of luminous flowers that grow in the earth. Lesson number three. They come from outside, above our heads. The uterine flesh-colored bubble still holds our school in a place next to time. Everything is still, but we wander. Lesson number four. There is a mask that lives in the darkness of the machinery room. Bodiless, it hangs in a corner. Some of the others whisper that they have seen it move, a wide blur zipping in the corners of eyes. Lesson number five. They assigned our duties in school uniforms. During the night, we walked the hallway in single file, watching the bobbing hair of the students before us. If we were unlucky, we found ourselves kneeling, lining the square. Lesson number six. There, we pick berries from bony white thorns in the night. It is always night. Lesson number seven. I listen as I pick the berries, pricking my skin, to the steps of the others passing behind me. Like this. Like this. Like this. Like this. Like this. Like this. A heartbeat that vibrates throughout the school and gets weaker with each passing round. Lesson number eight. I stare at him whenever I walk. He was in 4A, a year above me and kind. We never spoke, but I felt like he knew me in silence. Now he kneels with the others and picks berries in kind, both of our hands caked in redness. Lesson number nine. We all crack, inevitably. But he is still here, one in a row of three that once counted 30. For the first time, he looks back at me, over the square. When he meets my eyes, I feel like myself for a moment, both of our eyes screaming without making a sound. Lesson number 10. I almost panic when a piercing human sound tears the thin line between us. We both run our red fingers over our lips, still in silence. No, it was one of the children much better at hiding than we are. I wish I knew where they take them. Lesson number 11. They took him. Lesson number 12. I see more and more bones every night. Bird-like, crawling, their eyes gleaming green in their skulls. They're beautiful, even now that their tunnels narrow around me, and the roots of their flowers choke me as I breathe. Their green eyes remind me of his. Lesson number 14. I'm given to understand it's an honour, as they flank me on both sides protectively, so I don't spill the berries heaped in my bowl. I am last. Lesson number 15. I open the machine, like a bite. The white mask darts out, latches onto my face in starvation. The berries tumble into the machine, and my mask makes me follow.
So, this is great. This is a great piece.
Thank you.
And it really feels like you've painted a nightmare for us.
Is it a nightmare? I don't know. I've heard people say it is quite beautiful, and I've heard people say that it's horrific.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's beautiful in a nightmarish kind of way.
I appreciate that.
When dreams can be beautiful, like the imagery you described. But still.
I mean, we talked about Hannibal just a while ago.
Yeah.
I think that was the kind of vibe I was going for.
Mm-hmm.
Grotesque beauty.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I read it myself, I gave it a very different tone and pace in my head. And now when you just read it, you read it like in a very calm way that made me feel like the narrator of the piece or story or whatever you want to call it, is it a piece? And when I read it, I was like, oh my god, this person doesn't know what's going on. They're like really stressed out. They're so confused. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. And in the end, they kind of die. I don't know. Like, what? So it's really cool. That's.
Yeah. I think that's probably true, though. Like, I think how I read it is how they want to appear. In mm-hmm. my mind, it was a she. How she wants to appear. But I think this is how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
How she feels. Oh, you know, she's really, really scared. But
okay.
At the same time, she's also fascinated.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the reason why she survives so long is because she has the ability to appear calm. Because, you know, mm-hmm. they keep the quiet ones alive.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who's the quietest.
Mm-hmm.
But inside, I think she's definitely, you know, screaming mm-hmm. and running and going in circles. Yeah.
I think your reading brought some things out really well that I didn't notice when I read it on my own. What I was thinking of was the lines, and we run our fingers, mm-hmm. our red fingers over our lips. You know, that at first you think they run, but they don't run, really.
Fingers run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it based on a dream you had?
It is, yeah. It's very closely just like the dream that I had. The only difference is that in my dream, she wasn't the last one. In my dream, there were still other kids. And all the kids were regularly being sacrificed. And I don't know that. I don't know how you interpreted it, but in my head, the idea was kind of that these alien skeleton birds come to the school. And they want to feast, and so what they feast on is the berries that grow in the schoolyard, but they also feast on human blood. And so the way they do it is they bring the berries, they bring the students to bring the berries to the machine, and then the moment they put the berries in, the students get sucked in as well. And so the blood and the berries mix, and then they feast on that. But in my story, it isn't actually quite like that. In my story, they just eat the berries and kill all the other humans. And then she's the chosen one, so to say, who in the end gets to be turned into the blood berry feast. I don't know, it seemed more right like that.
Okay.
Well, that's really interesting, because one of my notes says, where is it? What is the machine? Is it making juice or blood? Because both are red liquids. I mean, I thought of red berries that make red juice, and blood, because they fall in and die.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I kind of imagined the machine being a very big juice machine, kind of. You throw in berries and then you get juice out. But you can also throw in children and get blood out.
I mean, you can throw children into juice machines. So.
She chopped them up first, yeah. I guess.
I mean, I imagined that one being a very big one.
Yeah, me too. I kind of imagine it too also being, you know, not realistically big. So technically, the student shouldn't fit. But there is this sort of black hole in the machine that just kind of sucks
mm-hmm.
with the mask.
What's recently been on your mind that might have caused this dream?
Whew, good question. I mean, I had the dream a while ago. I had it, I think, 3/4 of a year ago. And I think, what was it back then? I mean, the reason why it took me so long to write it down is because I didn't find the right format. I tried a normal poem, I tried prose, I tried everything. And then in the end, I kind of ended up with this. And so it took me roughly 9 months to finally get here. But back then, what could have inspired me? Oh, well, there is this one manga that I've read, the Ancient Mage's Bride, and it's about this demon who has a skull head. And he's called Elias. The whole story is very weird. It's basically an Oscar Wilde-ish story set in England with fairies and whatnot. And she gets married. She's 15, and she gets married to a millions of years old demon. And not even to go into the implications of that.
That's intense.
The story is actually not as horrific as I probably would have liked it to be. So maybe my subconscious wanted to fill in some of the gaps. Because the story itself tries to be very sweet. But I think that's probably not the way to go with a story like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So who would you say is the berry picker then? Is it a demon? Is it a person? Is it something completely different?
Well, in my head, the berry picker was the narrator. And she is, in my head, very much human.
Okay, I see.
Until the very end, when God knows what happens to her. But I'm honestly not quite sure that there might be this kind of archetype thing going on, because it's a bit of a series with the dreams that I've had. I also have the Lessons of the Woman Tree that I read in one of her readings. So I guess I'm working on the Lessons of the XY now or something. So let's see what happens with that. Maybe the berry picker is just a rough...
And do you think some of the berry picker's lessons can be or should be applied to real life?
They keep the quiet ones alive probably applies in a lot of situations. Whether you should abide by it is a different question. Interestingly you bring it up. I guess a lot of the lessons are a lot more about survival than they are about morality.
So actually it's a kind of a survival guide. So if you could write a book about surviving in horrific dystopian situations. Oh yes. I love it. It's so hilarious.
Basically the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean the school there was a bit less dystopian. It was still pretty dystopic. It was a weird school.
I just loved the wood crafting that they did all the time. I was like, why don't we have that one with the clock? I suppose the lesson I would urge people to apply is I see more and more. But then it goes on with bones every night, so I'm not so sure about that. I listen is a good one. I listen. There you go. That's good. It's clean. Can't get sued for that.
I think we can say it's pretty abstract. Yeah. The lessons are rather abstract. People can make what they will of them.
Yeah. When I read it in the meeting, some people said that they aren't actually lessons. Like, what do we have here?
Some of them, I think, are quite straightforward, and others are more mysterious.
Yeah, they assigned our duties. It's really a lesson.
Yeah, yeah.
So I agree with that. I don't know, it seemed right to have a sort of lesson system in school. I wish I could explain it. I can't.
Maybe it'll explain itself later, after a couple of these lessons.
Yeah.
Or in things always start to make sense in retrospective.
Once they put me in the machine, I'll probably understand. Maybe this, heralds the bringing of the aliens, and they just send the message through me.
I feel like there's almost some aspects of world building in there. Like, you've set a really, a very well-crafted and thought-out scene for the poem. And, the school and the uterine flesh-colored bubble, the machinery room, the hallway, the square. Did you have any specific place in mind when you wrote this?
Yeah, I mean, my dream, I guess, might be the obvious answer. I just dream very, very vividly. If I dream, I'm basically there. I had a time period where I managed to dream, what do you call it, lucidly?
Mm-hmm.
I don't do that so often anymore. If at all, it's just half lucid. It just was a lot of work, actually, to put in, to be so conscious. But when I did, that was a lot of fun. Like, I could actually fly. That was so cool. But still, if I dream, it's very vivid. And I was there. I saw the school. I couldn't say that it's an actual place that I've ever been to. It was all very geometric. It was a literal square. And I think the reason why I struggled so much with finding the right format was because I wanted to convey this sense of, you know, dread and doom that's in the architecture itself, and they just wander around the square and they keep wandering and wandering. And yeah, no, I could paint it for you if I was a better painter. And it's in my mind, yeah.
I agree with Leo, the images you create, they kind of reminded me of, I kind of really felt like I was there and I could see it, and it also made me think of, it could be a short film or a trailer for something.
That would be cool.
With the school and all this eerie, like, mood going around, nobody knows what's happening, and then this strange machine, and then somebody sitting in the back and just watching, and then those weird alien bird thingies, and then masks that get sucked in, and then the music. It would be really strange and creepy, but really good, I think.
Yeah, I think it would work really well, these devices where the screen goes black in between, which is... goes from the outside in.
Less than one.
And then you just see them walking down the hallway with the hair bobbing, and then there's like a thump, and the screen goes black again, and then the next picture.
That's so cool. I mean, if any of our listeners are feeling inspired, that would be so cool. Our video game, where you have to survive.
Yes, that'd be great.
Did you actually think of them as birds? Because when I read them, a lot of people didn't realize they were supposed to be
birds. Not necessarily, no. I just realized it when you said they were birds.
I had this kind of dinosaur-ish thing in mind. You know, they're literally just skeletons. And they literally look like moving dinosaur skeletons. But since dinosaurs turn into birds, eventually they also have these really long beaks. And that's what kind of makes them so...
Yeah, so you described the beaks, now it makes so much sense, of course, that they're birds. Yeah.
But still, it didn't get through to some people at the meeting as well, and I was like, maybe I should rephrase that, probably.
If you really want to make it into a game, I have a friend who's a game designer.
Oh, I have so many ideas for games. If your friend is ever bored, I have like 10 concepts lying around.
I could ask him if he was interested in being on the podcast just for fun. Because he's working in Berlin since a couple of years in the game designing world. And his English is perfect. So, yeah, maybe. For some reason, in a way... The Lessons of the Berry Picker made me think of Allen Ginsberg's Howl.
Ooh, that's such a compliment. I love that.
Because I think they're both very mysterious in a way and can be interpreted in multiple ways, which I always like about literature. And also the images that are created are kind of, I think, also there's a lot of imagery in both of them.
Mm.
And then I remembered you saying that, like, a while ago you... were writing or reading a lot of Ginsberg.
Yeah, it was... that might add up.
So I was wondering if you would say that Ginsberg influences you or has influenced your writing.
Maybe this particular piece
or something else.
Temporarily work out. Yeah, it might have been Ginsberg. It's kind of funny, isn't it, how, you know, in a review, you find the reasons for writing something for the first time, and you're like... you know my subconscious better than I do. But yeah, no, that might be it. I watched two movies about Ginsberg as well, and one of them was very, very interesting. It was a mixture of an interview where, what's his face? James Franco? I think James Franco plays Ginsberg.
Yeah.
And he reenacts the whole... trial about his book because people claimed that it was indecent and should be banned. And in the end, he won the trial by arguing that art should be free and so on. And vastly oversimplified. And then it was mixed with animated sequences of Howl. And it was so cool because the animation was something in between 2D and 3D, and it just kept changing its shape, and then the whole, I mean, it was set in the big city, obviously, because it's supposed to encapsulate that kind of spirit, but then you had monsters just flying over street lamps and all the people converging into one huge monster and just the things that you can do with animation that you just couldn't do in a normal movie. Mm-hmm. So everything changes and explodes and runs. Oh, that's so cool. And the whole color scheme was also very muted. Mm-hmm. So it might have inspired me in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Probably.
And also, I mean, there are... you can just go on YouTube and Google Howl, and then you have Ginsberg reading it 10 mm-hmm. minutes.
I actually don't like his reading.
And it's just, the way he read it is very, I think also kind of was for me kind of different to how I always read Howl. Because he's also kind of rather calm, which is weird in a way, because it's kind of such a revolutionary poem in a way.
Yeah. I don't know, I listened to it as well back then, and it disappointed me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, sometimes authors just aren't very good readers, mm-hmm. actually, and they shouldn't be allowed to read their own stuff. I was at a reading once, and the story was brilliant, and she just butchered her own work with her own voice. It was such a tragedy. I don't know if one day people will say that about me, but it just hurt so much just listening to it. But with Ginsberg, I thought... I don't know, maybe he just wants to appeal to the audience.
But I think it's better to be a good writer and a shitty reader than being a shitty writer and a good reader, because that also is possible. I've also went to readings where people had kind of a very bad piece of writing, but they read it in a fantastic way, so the audience was kind of like, yeah, this is so great, and I was like, okay.
And then you go home and you're like... Why did I buy this?
Yeah,
so far.
Exactly.
I mean, they can always go into voice acting if the writing doesn't work out
for most people. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, that's... Yeah, I think also the style, you know, the kind of beat thing,
mm-hmm.
that inspired me a lot. It mm-hmm. might be Charlotte, the way you know me.
Mm.
Yeah.
I drink and I know things. Like Tyrion Lannister would say that.
I feel very transparent.
If you're like Tyrion, you shouldn't have turned down the wine before.
True.
You were offered.
I mean, wine I am drinking, but it's non-alcoholic.
Is that why you're only drinking from your own bottle? Are you afraid I'm going to poison you?
No, this is actually vodka.
All right. Water, he says. Mm-hmm.
In the poem, at one point, you said, "We all crack eventually."
Hmm.
Did the speaker crack, though? The speaker kind of kept their... We already talked about this. They didn't really keep their cool, but they kept up the outward facade, kind of.
I mean, I don't know if you noticed this, but lesson 13 is missing. And I kind of imagined that lesson 13 is where that happens.
I didn't notice that lesson 13 was missing. This is so good. This is so great.
Thank you. It's also the same with Lessons of the Woman Tree. It's kind of a theme that one lesson is just gone. And in my head, the idea is that in that lesson that is not shown, the transformation happens, sort of. So you have the before and the after. And this is why, until lesson 13, she kind of just does their bidding. And then in lesson 14, she's already on their side. And she walks in a machine and is eaten, sacrificed, however you want to say it. So I think that is the moment when she just either completely gives in, or at least sees that she doesn't have any other chance of leaving. But from the very beginning, she's very taken in by them. She just thinks they're beautiful and so on. So I think, I'm not sure if she had to crack, you know? If you want to be super pseudo-intellectual, you might say she was cracked from the beginning. Now, I don't know, but I do think that him disappearing, whoever he is, the boy from Foray, that it hurt her a lot.
I really like that we don't know how they all got there and how this all happened. It's really like you're thrown in there and you kind of as confused or desperate as the people who are experiencing this.
Yeah, I also wasn't there in the beginning of my dream. I just kind of saw them descending from this bubble and they took over the school. And
yeah, I love that about dreams, that often you have no idea how you got somewhere, but it doesn't matter to you because you're like, I'm there and I'm kind of dealing with the things happening around me.
Yeah, there was that famous line from Inception, isn't it? Where they're in the dream and she's like, yeah, but I mean, how would I know it's a dream? It's like, well, how did you get here? And mm-hmm. she's like, I did it. And then she realized she's in a dream.
Yeah.
And just, ah, it's so good.
Yeah, really good, yeah.
It's really hard kind of to point to exactly what this poem makes me feel. It certainly makes me feel something, but I can't really grasp what it is. What does it make you feel? What did you feel while writing it?
It's a very particular feeling, isn't it? It's something very unlike other things. I think that's why I wanted to write it down so much. It wasn't just anger or fear or love or whatever. I think kind of hopelessness, a kind of giving in-ness.
Desperation.
I'm not so sure if it's desperation, because she's not that desperate. Or something that is, you know, a desperation that is so deep already that you try to transform it into acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
The 4-5 Stages of Dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross are kind of, in the beginning, you bargain because you don't want to. And then there's depression at some point, and then there's anger.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's desperation, I think, and then there's acceptance, mm-hmm. finally.
Yeah,
I think I messed the order up now, but those are those stages. And maybe they apply to her, too, because she knows that she eventually can't help dying anymore.
Yeah, I think you could do a reading like that, definitely. But she is very accepting from the beginning, mm-hmm. probably just because she doesn't have a choice. So she probably just went through the other stages very quickly.
Yeah, maybe it's
this is fine, this is great.
Yeah, we just catch her at her acceptance stage, maybe.
Or maybe in the very last stage, it's finally acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
No, emotions always confuse me. I wish I could pin down my own emotions a lot better. So I guess it just makes sense that my writing is just as emotionally confused. I don't know. This is kind of how I see most emotions, I think. Kind of a mess. It's like, it's there. All right.
But yeah, I think that's a really good observation, because I guess in every sad story there's always some moments of laughter and happiness and joy, and vice versa. So there's just never just one.
Actually, that might be it. It's bittersweet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I was going for.
How would you classify this piece of your writing? Would you say it's a poem, or is it something completely different?
I wish I knew.
Okay, it's something new, probably.
I guess it's... I mean, you couldn't really argue that it's prose, could you? If it had to be classified, I suppose it would be poetry, irregular modern poetry. But it also doesn't really feel like poetry to me. It's something in between for me, yeah. Poetry.
Prose.
When you're really good at poetry, it's poetry.
Poetry. I'm not a poet, I'm a proet. Yeah.
It sounds like a skater. Skater poet.
Oh, God.
Would you say that your dreams often influence you? Or is it kind of... Because, I mean, imagination in dreams is even weirder or more limitless than imagination in a kind of more sane state, I would say. If that exists. So I was wondering if your imagination ever has any limits, either when you're awake or when you're dreaming.
That's two very loaded questions. Well, I guess the first one, definitely. I've always had a very, very close relationship with my dreams. I've always annoyed my parents with it in the morning. When I was like 6 or 7, I would just run up to the breakfast table and be like, oh my God, you won't guess what I dreamed. And tell us about it, honey. And they're like, really? Yeah. No. And they just kept eating their breakfast, and I just went on and off about what I saw and what I'd seen. And yeah. And I do think that for me, dreams have always been kind of a gate into my subconscious. Mm-hmm. Kind of a, oh, so I guess this is what's going on. So I hardly ever have nightmares, which is probably because I'm just so tight with my subconscious. But like, we're buddies, you know, my subconscious and I, we get along very well. And sometimes it just kind of mocks up and it's like, actually, we're going through a tough phase right now. And then I'm like, oh, okay, let's work this out. And but it's still not really a nightmare. It's more of a, hey, this is kind of uncomfortable. And I'm like, all right, fine, let's deal with it. And I think the biggest indicator in my dreams is probably fish. Weirdly enough.
Okay.
Because if I often dream about like watery surfaces and seas and lakes and being underwater and whatnot. And I think the fish are very much an indicator of how fine my subconscious is at the moment. Like if I swim along with the fish and everything's fine, that's great. But I have so many dreams where I'm just trying to get into some kind of body of water and there are these huge, just humongous water animals, like the size of New York, just underneath me. And that's always a moment I'm like, right, I guess I've got some things to work through. So that's, you know, that's kind of a thing.
It's almost like metaphorical in a way. They're just below the surface.
Exactly. Like, I didn't know what it was with the fish. I just noticed that they kept cropping up again and again. And then when I was in Aberdeen, I talked to Christina about it, a friend that I made there. And she was like, well, let's Google it. And I was like, well, why are you going to Google? And she was like, fish are indicative of your subconscious. And I was like, I guess that makes sense. Like, maybe it's just some kind of weird system of symbolism that I've created for myself at some point because I had fish, and so my childhood mind was like, I'm as good as the fish are, or we connected in some way. But at some point my brain must have decided, yes, this is a reasonable connection to make. If there are big fish, you need to think about it. If there are small fish, it's fine. So here we are. Me and the fish.
No fish in this story.
No.
Just big skeletal bats.
Yeah, I guess that means my mind was on other things and not on my subconscious. They're not in every dream, but if they are, it usually means something. So yes, dreams do influence me. Not in the way that I take them as gospel or I think they're prophecies or something, but in the way that I'm like, so this is on my mind, I guess.
And how do your, like the things you make up with your mind in dreams differ from the things that you make up when you're not dreaming, but when you're kind of awake?
I suppose the biggest difference is that they surprise me.
Okay.
So in reality, I can usually expect what's going to happen. Not always, of course, but mostly when I go along the street, I can guess, yeah, there's going to be cars and people and whatnot. But dreams, they always throw something at you, don't they? And then you're like, okay, here's a flying cat. Nice. But as to the limits, can't really say. I mean, I always had a very active imagination, for better or worse. Not worse. And I had this period in my life when whenever I went to school, I tried to imagine the houses interacting with me. So they would kind of jump out of where they were standing and dance along the street like some kind of weird Disney Hollywood movie. And then I would take like the street lamps and put them through the house, and then I'd make wings out of trees or whatnot. And that kind of helped the boredom when I was in school.
That kind of reminds me of Alice in Wonderland, because I think there's this legend that it came into existence because the author was on drugs. But whenever I hear that, I tell them, you don't have to be on drugs to have that kind of imagination.
No, you don't. I think it depends on the person, too.
Yeah.
I think some people are blessed with a calmer conscience, and some people are blessed with a more colourful one. And both definitely do have their advantages. So whenever I tell my mom about it, she's very imaginative, but she's usually like, Child, why? The limits, I have to admit, I never really thought about it. Limits in my dreams. I mean, there's the one taxing thing with the, there is nothing new under the sun, and so on. But sometimes I kind of fear that I won't ever see anything in my dreams that I haven't seen in real life.
Okay.
And I wish that would happen. You know, I wish someday something would crop up that's just completely out of the blue. It has nothing to do with reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so far it has never happened.
So, have you ever seen skeletal birds then?
I was just about to ask the same.
No, that's not so much what I mean. I mean the mixture, you know. Like, if you see something in your dreams, it's usually just things from reality put into a blender
mm-hmm.
and then shaken out again mm-hmm. in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want is a new ingredient, you know, mm-hmm. something that just doesn't exist in reality. And I don't know if you can actually access something like that by just your imagination, or if your imagination is always limited to things you've seen just put together mm-hmm. in you. So
maybe, I mean, you said before that you're never really scared in your dreams, like you don't really have nightmares.
Rarely, yeah.
Maybe that's a limitation, which wouldn't be a bad one necessarily, because having nightmares and being frightened isn't usually very comfortable or nice.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, yeah, I am scared, but maybe I'm just too brave.
Probably, yeah.
That's probably it, yeah.
No, I honestly can't explain. I think it's rather the opposite, to be honest. I think I'm so much of a coward that at some point I decided I don't want to be scared anymore. And so I took all the necessary precautions, and if that meant becoming best friends with my subconscious, then so be it. I very vividly remember a young child and being like, oh, this is uncomfortable, I don't want this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then just very much consciously planning ahead on how to avoid this. Yeah, I think that might be what has happened.
What is this that you're avoiding now?
Oh dear, this seems like a therapy session. No, but definitely just, you know, uncomfortable feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Fear, Weltschmerz, that kind of thing. You know, when you're a child, you feel so helpless in the face of these things. You're like overpowered. You don't have any methods of coping. And so I think whenever I encountered like a big emotional or intellectual beast like that I just couldn't tame yet, I'd very much try to find ways of dealing. And that might be part of it.
That reminds me of a film I recently saw. It's called 7 Minutes to Midnight. It's about a boy who is faced with challenges in his life. And so to cope with them, he has very vivid dreams that try to... He kind of creates a monster in his dreams that is protecting him.
Oh, I think I saw that. Is that the one where the monster's like drawn?
Yes.
I saw the trailer, yes. It looked yes. so cool. I really... 7 Minutes to Midnight,
yeah,
is it?
That's
yeah,
what
I forgot
called.
The title and I wanted to watch it. Isn't there somebody who has cancer too?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a novel that was written by a woman, I think, but then she died and then somebody made a film, something like that. I forgot the story. But it's a very touching story because it's kind of his way of coming to terms with his mother's terminal illness and her dying, and that's his way of coping with that. And it's very, yeah, very touching, of course, because he's, I think, 12 or 13. Yeah.
Yeah, I loved the trailer. I saw it in the movie theaters and I was like...
And there are great actors in there too, like, top notch.
I think dreams are kind of underexplored, if you ask me. Like, everybody has them to some capacity.
Well, Freud kind of explored a lot of dreams.
In his own weird way.
Yes.
I think there's a pretty fundamental problem with dreams that they'll never mean as much to another person as they mean to you.
I don't know.
With some people like talking about dreams, but there are also others who like aren't interested in that at all.
Yeah. But I think most of my friends are very interested in dreams. Like, one of my friends in particular, Tessa, we always spend ages just talking about our dreams. And I actually, she told me a dream that she'd had, I think, a year ago. And she didn't remember the bits and pieces in the middle. And so I made up a story connecting them. Mm-hmm. And I gave it to her for Christmas. And I think you can learn a lot about a person by the way that they dream. Not necessarily in a Freudian way, you know, not in the, oh, well, you have a daddy complex kind of way, but in the, so this is how your mind constructs meaning kind of way. And that's just, I think it's an interesting window into people's minds.
That's really interesting. Now I want to write a story about two people who just interact with each other about their dreams.
Ooh.
And then really get to know each other in this weird way. Ooh.
Go for
imagination
it.
Running wild.
Go for it. That sounds interesting. Yeah. If they know nothing about each other but their dreams. Yeah.
Do you always remember your dreams?
Not always, but most of the time.
And then you remember them in detail, or do you have to write them down right after you wake up?
It's a pretty even split, I would say.
Okay.
Some of them I wake up with and I'm like, the cat! Or cat. And I just remember, like, the little things. But sometimes I wake up and it's like, I just saw a movie. And, mm-hmm. Or I was the main character in the movie. And then, of course, I remember everything. It's usually that, you know, when you wake up and you fall asleep again. Mm-hmm. And then you have a dream. Mm-hmm. You usually remember that one very well.
Mm-hmm.
I think because you're actually already rested. And then your mind's just like, okay, let's go for the garbage pile. And it does its thing. But I think from the middle of the night or something, those dreams just trickle down mm-hmm. and disappear. Most of the time.
Agreed. I barely ever remember my dreams. I mean, I do, but I have to tell them to someone mm. right after I wake up, or write them down, or else they're gone.
Yeah.
And even then, while I'm telling them, they're disappearing.
I know that. Yeah, that's such a weird feeling.
Yeah, and it's I'm so angry about it sometimes, because it was so fantastic or so weird or so scary, and I want to tell someone, and I can't because it's, yeah, they're...
It's like you're sliding down a slope of forgetting, and yes, you can't find a grip.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Everything's eluding you.
Like in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the rain of forgetting.
In the end of the movie.
Oh, yes.
Where people step in and once they're hit by the rain, they keep forgetting.
It's a good scene, actually.
Yeah.
To be completely honest with you, I just remember the sick bird. That was the only thing that really stuck with me. But yeah, I guess it's kind of how Alzheimer or something similar must feel like, that you sort of remember and you try to grasp it, but you can't quite. Just for regular memories. The brain is such a weird thing.
Yeah.
How about you?
I hardly ever remember my dreams either. But yeah, I remember those that just kind of traumatise me.
So you have scary dreams very often?
They're not really scary as hell, they're just overwhelming and confronting me with situations I can't handle.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because I once read an article that actually dreams are just about that. That the reason why we have dreams is that your brain realizes, oh, in real life, there's a situation we can't handle yet. So we're going to run simulations until you can.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually makes a lot of sense to me, because that would be such a smart way of handling life, you know, that your brain is just like, and here you go, and here you go, and here you go, and here you go. Oh, you've got a solution? Okay, here's something else. And that just makes a lot of sense to me.
But then sometimes, I mean, I recently dreamt of a dog. Like somebody said, oh, look, that's my dog. And then the dog actually was a cat and a crocodile at the same time. It was really strange. And I was like, that's not a dog. And then he kept referring to it as a dog. Yeah, that was really strange. And so, I mean, yes, okay, I haven't been in a situation where a dog was actually a cat crocodile. So I probably couldn't deal with that if I was ever in that situation. But then again, would that ever happen?
No, I mean, maybe it's more on a, you know, semiotic level. Maybe it's more like you encountered something that a lot of people said was one thing, but you clearly saw it something else, and then you just had to make sense of it, you know?
Yeah, agreed.
Could be.
True, yeah.
What a great dog you are.
Okay, yeah.
As you've Tumblr with it, where people call everything a doggo, just no matter what it is.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that.
Like, you see a picture of any animal, and it's like, good dog.
Okay.
Okay.
It reminds me of that one bit in Astor's movie where the one guy is like, look at my new dog. And the other guy is, there is no dog. And then they're like, both like, ah. Oh.
Cool.
Dreams. You know, I could talk about dreams all day. It's just so fascinating to me. They really work, and you have them. And do you guys remember your earliest dream?
Let me think.
No idea. I generally have a bad memory of my own life. Mm. It's all kind of gone.
I remember that ages ago, I think I must have been 6 or 7, I went to a theatre, a children's theatre with my mom and my sister. It was The Ghost of Canterville. Mm. And I remember being horribly traumatized by the beheading scene. And then I had years and years and years where I had the same dream. It's one of my earliest dreams. It was that my sister and me were at our flat in the kitchen and somebody was knocking on the door.
Mm.
And we knew, okay, it's not nobody we know, it's something bad. And then we hid behind the table and then the door was opened and this weird being entered and took off its head.
Wow.
And that's the earliest dream I can remember. And I was so scared every night, and I had to sleep in my parents' bed for years because it haunted me.
I think it was traumatized by the same thing. Is it in The Ghost of Canterville that somebody gets walled in and dies behind the wall?
I think you mean Edgar Allan Poe.
No, there's like a ghost story as well.
There's like a movie. Possible. Maybe. I don't remember it that closely. I just know that he was like the ghost of Canterville. Was beheaded and then haunts the mansion where he used to live and falls in love with the daughter of the family who moves there.
Okay, now the one story I remember is where somebody was, you know, locked into a room and then they put bricks in front of the door and then the
person died. Oh my god, maybe that's in there too, it's possible. But I don't remember that well. Do you remember your earliest dreamery?
Yes, I'm just looking at the Cantervilles. Wow.
Maybe I think there is a scene where they lock the daughter away because she's in love with that ghost. Something strange happens in that family.
Here, it's just a lot of family drama, I can see. Yes, my earliest dream was the one that I remember, was a really weird one. It was a white room, and in the middle there was a pedestal, and I just learned to read. And so I walked towards the pedestal, and there was an apple on it. And suddenly when I looked at the apple, the word apple appeared on the wall, and a low computer-like voice said, apple, in German. And it just kept happening. Like, the written word kept appearing on the wall until the wall was covered in the word apple, black on white, like in a book. And then I just stood there the whole night looking at the apple and went, apple, 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 the whole night. And that was kind of a nightmare, to be honest. And I kept having that dream. I think something in my brain was readjusting to reading letters now, and it was just like, apple.
It sounds like a modern play apple. To me.
My brain's like a modern play.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was weird.
Mm-hmm.
But also kind of fun. I don't know. It's definitely unusual. Like, I remember when I told my friends about it in elementary school and they were like...
Dude.
They were like...
Dude.
Right. Yeah. Question. Did you think that it had anything to do with colonialism?
So are you interviewing us now?
No, because at the meeting, a girl was like, but you intended for this to be a criticism of colonialism, right? And I was like...
Oh yeah, it does ring the bell of, like, residential schools.
Yeah, I think there was...
missionary schools, stuff like that.
You could read it like that.
Yeah.
Did you?
No, I didn't think of that, but yeah, it would make sense.
Mm.
It was like a horrible plot of our history.
Yeah, because, you know, the more that I read it myself, I was like, oh wow, yeah, the white mask? Look at that, that's a symbolism right there. Mm. And I didn't intend for it at all.
Mm.
Isn't that what the Franz Fanon book is called?
The what?
The Franz Fanon book, that black face, white mask.
I read that. Ring the bell. For our listeners, maybe they're interested in hearing in your own words, what would you say, what do you usually write? Is it more prose or poetry or something completely different?
It's called Black Skin, White Mask.
Black Skin, White Mask.
It's funny because I keep talking about myself as a crime author, but I haven't actually written a single crime story.
Maybe what you write is just a crime.
Maybe. I'm so bad. But the story I've been working on for the past 5 years now is a crime story, which is, I think, why I still use that moniker. So there was that project, which takes so long. It just gets bigger and bigger, and I just really try to contain it. It's really hard. Like, honestly, at this point, I'm at 5 books. I have 5 books planned. I'm just like, why? I haven't even written a single one. but these days I'm very busy. I think the only thing I really get to write is poetry and very, very short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually just come out in bursts. I wish I could say I had more of an actual writing routine at the moment, but this semester was all about the anthology.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad that went through.
Yay!
Also, oh my god, today is the actual first day that we're an official Verein.
Woo!
Can you believe it?
Yay!
We're legal now.
Yes!
We're not pirates anymore.
Forbidden gatherings.
So yes, we're legally recognized by the law. We're good citizens now. That was a lot of work. I actually wrote a lot of legal documents this semester and nonfiction. But usually when I write, it's I don't know if I really have a genre. I think the only thing I've never tried to write was a romance story. That has not happened yet. Everything else, I think I've given a shot.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think there's some romance in your poem, though. I mean, that's like very childlike, school kind of romance.
But that's what we talked about before. There's never just one thing in a story.
Yeah.
I mean, also like in a person's life, it's never just romance. It's never just horrible. It's never just great. It's always kind of everything at the same time, maybe, or some of those things happening at the same time, then others never happening, or others happening 50 years later, we don't know.
Actually, I did write a romance, I just remembered. It was part of a book that I wrote for NaNoWriMo when I was 16, and it was two parallel stories. One was about a girl battling depression, and one was about a guy who fell in love with his English teacher. And inexplicably, the English teacher and the girl psych therapist were the same person. And also not a real person at all, more of an idea. And she was called Mrs. C. And in the end, it was just a thing that both of them really desperately wanted and needed in their life, but that wasn't actually there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, they both had a psychotherapist and they had an English teacher, but it wasn't the person they imagined it to be.
Okay.
And so he starts this long relationship with Mrs. C, and it goes really into horrible detail of their ghastly relationship. And she figures out herself, and then in the end, she triumphs and she goes to C.
Mm-hmm.
Back then at 16, I thought was very clever because she's called Mrs. C. Mm. C-C. And then at the end, it turns out that he never had a relationship with his teacher and he just imagined the whole thing.
Well, that's better, I guess.
Yes, but it also shows the depths of his delusion. And in the end, he just marries like a standard girl and tries to live a standard life. But all the while, there is this side to him that he never really got to explore, and one day it's going to explode.
Okay.
Yeah.
So kind of like A Beautiful Mind, in a way, where the first time you watch that film, it kind of blows your mind because you didn't get that he was just imagining these things, and you thought they were really happening, and then it's like,
what?
Oh my god.
Yeah.
I think this is all we have time for today. Would you maybe tell people where they can find you or your work on the internet before we go?
I don't really have a place yet. I've been thinking about setting up a website, but I haven't yet. I'll let you know as soon as I have one.
On my interview episode, I asked people to, because I've been meaning to do the same, I've been meaning to install a blog for a while, but I can't think of a name, so I asked people I begged them practically to provide me with a name.
actually already have a name, because I was thinking about... Because actually I wanted to write a book this year. I didn't have any time for that. But the project itself is called Adsomnia... Oh god. Adsomnia Pest... Adsomnia Pestilum. Yeah, that's it. So, to your dreams with your pen. Hey.
Perfect.
Yeah, so I think that's what I'm going to call my website at some point, maybe. But I don't know, time. Yeah, maybe my dreams. Sort of slip into a parallel universe and do something there. That'd be handy. Try to TARDIS.
Yeah, a bit, I mean, yeah. Who doesn't?
Yeah.
Everybody wants to have a TARDIS.
So cool.
Yeah.
We can stay in there forever. Like, just take a break, just take a holiday. Just stay in there for 2 months and then go back, and nobody even knows.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't deliberately do this because the TARDIS does whatever it wants.
And it can't really control it.
I mean, it shouldn't. It's just malfunctioning all the time.
Yeah. Well... To advertise the Universe website, some of our writings are there as well, so you can check that out.
At universe.univ.org.
Correct. And I think you probably have heard about my blog a couple of times now, but...
I'll still put it in the show
notes. Yes, you can find it under detintenfish.wordpress.com. Check it out.
Yeah, and as always, I still don't have a blog, so maybe the interview episode isn't out as of now, as we are recording this episode, so maybe I'll have a blog already by the time this comes out. But if I don't, you can still find me at Leo Engelmeyer on Twitter.
No blog buddies.
Yay, no blog buddies. This was episode 13 of the Universe podcast. If you enjoyed it and would like to hear more of us, make sure to subscribe to the Universe podcast wherever you're listening to it. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review to tell us what you think and help other people find the podcast. And tell all your friends about it. Comments? Questions? You can reach us on Twitter, we're at PodUniverse, on Facebook, or on our email address, podcast@universe.univ.org. This podcast was edited and hosted by Leonhard Engelmeyer. The co-host was Charlotte Zerz. Our guest on this episode was Marie-Therese Sauer.
Hey!
On the editorial board for this episode was also Charlotte Zerz.
Thank you.
And myself, yes. I hope to visit this planet in the universe again. In the meantime, stay safe in space. Thanks for listening.